Why do we think the way we think? That is really at the crux of this episode. And I had Kieran O'Regan on, who is a sports scientist, a strength conditioning coach, and a doctoral student on to talk about these ideas, the philosophy around thinking. And you might be wondering, well, what does a strength conditioning coach know about philosophy? Well, that's the reason I had Kieran on, because he takes an interest in learning outside of this field. And that's something that I take pride on as well. Now, the reason that I want to get into this is due to all the issues that we've been seeing lately. Originally, I wanted to have Kieran on to talk about the pandemic, all the conspiracy theories around the pandemic and why people are so averse to science. Why do people look for these alternate explanations? And so we get into explaining some of these, the thinking behind these types of people. We get into different biases, and we get into just foundationally, what is knowledge? So I do want to warn you, it does get dense at times, specifically from minute 17 to minute 20. He gives a pretty in-depth explanation into what epistemology is, which is the study of knowledge. So go ahead and skip that if you don't want to learn about Einstein. But if you are interested, feel free to take a listen to that. Now, again, this episode was really long. I split it into two parts. So first part is about an hour long, and the next part will be about 2 hours long, and we could have kept going for even longer. It was a wealth of knowledge, and I know I say that about a lot of guests I have on, but I think this episode really lays the foundation for the episodes that are following. I want to start this mini series around the social unrest, around racism, around systemic issues. So I've interviewed several other specialists and scholars in these areas. But again, I wanted to start off with just philosophy, a philosophical understanding of knowledge, of thinking, of how we think the way we think. And if you're wondering, well, Jules, your health podcast, you know, I want to learn more about sports and performance. At a foundational level, this does affect our health, because our environment is in some ways affected by society. And as we've seen, both physically and mentally, our realities and our environments have shifted a lot throughout this pandemic, and with all the issues that we've been seeing, racism, police brutality, etc. And these have been around for a long time. These are things that affect many people, regardless of whether you're a person of color, black, brown, or any other marginalized group. This affects everyone as a whole. And again, you know, people really want solidarity. They want peace, harmony. We cannot ignore these issues anymore. So I've taken it upon myself to continue to educate myself on these issues and educate others. So without further ado, Kieran O'Regan.
No problem, it's my pleasure. The topics that you were hoping to discuss are some of my favorite topics to discuss. So any opportunity, man, they're topics that I feel are extremely important, not just within the coaching world, but in any aspect of life.
You know? Absolutely. That's why, you know, I wanted to have you on. When I listened to you on Sigma Radio, Sigma Nutrition Radio, you know, it's kind of blowing my mind, because, you know, you don't really hear about how to think. You know, we in the nutrition, the fitness world, the health world, we like to look at the stats, look at the numbers, and that's kind of the end goal, right? That's the output. But we don't really look at the underlying method of how to get there. And again, outside of that, outside of this world, like you said, you know, it can apply to anything. So that's really why I found this to be like perfect timing with the pandemic and just so many different opinions out there, so much different information, quote unquote, out there. And I don't want to throw you a curveball, but with what's going on in America and I guess across the entire world right now, you know, a lot of protests around not just police brutality, but again, these underlying issues. So I did want to kind of get into that a little bit. So I don't want to like throw you for a loop and just, you know, give you a surprise, but I wanted to.
I'll be more than happy to, man. That's the thing. I'll be definitely more than happy to it because again, the beauty of these kind of, I suppose you could call them. Yeah. Cause that's what it is. It's metacognition. Mm. And the beautiful thing about metacognition is that they're principles that apply regardless of what it is we're trying to formulate opinions on.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's just, and I think that's the relevance. Like even in the very first Sigma article that I wrote on this was called Uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I finished with a line from one of my favorite poems, from a W.B. Yeats poem from 1919, which is obviously a very turbulent year just after the Second World War had only finished. And there was all revolutions all over the world. That was the year of the first student protests in Tiananmen Square, where that led to the formulation of the Communist Party. It was all sorts of, it was only 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. There was all sorts of things. And the line essentially went along the lines of, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And he was essentially relating to, and it sounds kind of strange, but what he was essentially relating to was, from my understanding, was that, and that's the poem where the famous line came from, the center cannot hold, was the line. It's just that people who are able to, I suppose what he means by lacking all conviction is a good thing, which is that people are willing to weigh up complexity and nuance and operate in terms of shades of gray, rather than operate in binary black and white thinking, you know. And that's the thing. It's like, am I able to weigh up seeming juxtapositions or superposition of simultaneous things, you know? So obviously with this crack in America, that it's simultaneously the case that there's obviously issues with police training, selection process, how these policemen are being, or policemen and are being selected, and how it is they're being screened, and how it is they're being punished or sanctioned, because apparently this guy had a number of other previous sanctions prior to this event. And it's simultaneously the case here. And also it's simultaneously the case that there's upstream issues that need to be addressed, where there's disproportionate amounts of African-American people in impoverished situations. So what are these upstream issues up here that are leading to a disproportionate amount of engagement between African-Americans and the police? And simultaneously, what's going on with the issues with police? So it's like, and these are complex issues, and it's not all police are evil, or obviously it's not, there's something wrong with black people. So it's like, so it's neither, both of those statements are ridiculous. So it's just like, well, what's going on from a nuance and complexity? What are the issues here, rather than attaching overly simplistic labels that then overly simplistic labels, they just create conflict and kind of they put up really clear barriers, rather than allowing for a discussion to take place in which kind of reality can be reached and truth can be reached, or at least if not reached, then orientated towards, rather than having this lines of discussion that I suppose marginalize or disenfranchise or make other people angry, you know. I'd be more than happy to talk about
absolutely. Yeah. I don't want to take you out of your train of thought. That was some great stuff. But I want to give you the chance to kind of introduce yourself and your background, because again, coming from this kind of sports world, we don't hear a lot of people kind of touch on the philosophical side of things. It's kind of more of like, you know, here's the best exercise to do, you know, hip thrusts or this percent better than squats and da da da. But, you know, a lot of content I see you post is more methodical and a lot of, you know, philosophical texts that you've been reading and stuff like that. So give a little bit about your background, and then we can jump in. I want to talk about like ontology and epistemology. Like, I think that would be a good kind of place to start to kind of kick it off.
Yeah. So background wise, I suppose I'll start with college, in that I'll say basically, I graduated with a sport and exercise sciences degree in 2012. And while I was in university, I took up boxing and combat sports. Boxing essentially then, and then I switched into other combat sports later on, but I'd done some other martial arts and stuff as a kid, but I took up amateur boxing while I was in university, which is quite late to take up, because usually a lot of the people take up boxing at a very young age. But I took it up anyway as like 20, 21-ish. And then long story short, as a result of fighting competitively, I got very interested in, and I'd done some sports psych stuff in university, but as a result of the fighting stuff, I got very interested in Japanese samurai culture, and particular one particular swordsman, a guy called Miyamoto Musashi, who I'm not sure if you're familiar.
Not the most familiar with the martial arts world, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, I said we froze for a second.
You're good now. I see you.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So basically I got interested in this dude Musashi as a result of a particular book I came across called The Fighter's Mind, written by Sam Sheridan. And in that chapter, there's a really good, so basically if this book Fighter's Mind was just a series of interviews with a bunch of different coaches and fighters. And one of them was a coach, Virgil Hunter. He's based in Oakland. And he's the coach of one of my favorite fighters of all time, this Andre Ward is his name. And in that chapter, Virgil Hunter mentioned A Book of Five Rings by Musashi as being one of the most influential sources influential pieces of content he'd ever come across as a coach. I can't remember the exact wording. And because he essentially discussed, well, the way he kind of put it was that these samurai didn't prepare as if there was winners and losers. They prepared as if there was winners and dead guys.
Mm.
And that he was like, well, if I want to take that approach to my boxers, which is to prepare them with this utmost of seriousness, you know, as it related to the potential outcomes of their fights. And it also is the case that people do die in boxing matches. So if you prepare as if that's an actual possibility, then you're more likely, I think, to leave no stone unturned. So then I after reading this and reading that book, it was really, really enjoyable book. I got The Book of Five Rings by Musashi. That got me into a bunch of philosophy, and that just kicked me off on that rabbit hole. But before I go into that, I suppose that was just like almost like a gateway drug for me into the world of philosophy. Which I hadn't really had much exposure to or interest in before. So that led to some other stuff down the line of getting into some Stoicism and Marcus Aurelius, and then just going down more and more rabbit holes, and then realizing that there was all this wisdom there that could be brought back into my own coaching and my own sports and my fighting and then coaching. So what I actually do professionally is I'm a coach, strength and conditioning coach, kind of performance coach, I suppose. I'm not even really the biggest fan of the phrase strength and conditioning coach, because it's almost like it kind of almost narrows you, or so it's too narrow. I nearly prefer, because it almost like separates, well, it's strength and conditioning, and then they're loaded terms. I nearly even just prefer the phrase conditioning coach, where you just do stuff to condition the athlete for the demands at hand, for the demands of the of their sport. I nearly prefer that by itself, because then conditioning could include anything.
Right, more all-encompassing.
Yeah, yeah. Because then it's not just force production or muscle mass or rate of force development or any of that stuff. You're not isolating it. So anyway, that's what I work as. And then I help fighters make weight with Sigma Nutrition, and I do some kind of conditioning, performance coaching stuff with fighters with Sigma. And then I'm also a doctoral student doing a professional doctorate with University of Central Lancashire, and a doctorate in elite performance orientated around, it's kind of taking a sports psychology direction. So sports psych direction, looking at kind of athlete values and athlete value structures. And I suppose you could say stress management and potentially how it is that the underlying value structure of the athlete may negatively or positively influence that athlete's ability to navigate stressful scenarios. So essentially what I'm interested in looking at from a research perspective is, and I'm still figuring out, I have a big paper just finished a few weeks ago and we're going to, it's the first draft of it. So we'll see how that goes, but it's essentially looking at, and it kind of fits in with the philosophy psychology stuff big time, because it's like, well, what is the reason for the athlete being there in the first place? And does that why influence what it is that the athlete is going to be able to do in high pressured scenarios, or at least influence it? So I'm still navigating what's the best way to explore, because I'm only in my first 6-7 months of the research. So so that's what I do. I'm a strength and conditioning coach, sport, sport and exercise scientist, working as a strength and conditioning coach, and I'm a doctoral candidate, and I have a penchant for studying philosophy and psychology way above my pay grade, especially because I've been punched in the head thousands of times. So I don't know if my brain works as well as it should, but and part of my interest in philosophy then fits in with science and scientific thinking and critical thinking and like we were discussing, like epistemology and what do we know and how do we know what we know and what information is potentially more likely to be an accurate reflection of reality than what other information.
Right.
So that's basically that's a bit of a background. And I live in Cork in Ireland, which is so it's a nice city, second biggest city in Ireland. It's still nice and small. It's Cork is to Dublin what Boston would be to New York, I suppose, in terms of a lot of similarities in terms of scale and everything. So that's me, man. That's
right on.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So it definitely sounds like, you know, jack of all trades, but that's kind of how I kind of approach my own strength conditioning philosophy. You know, I don't like to just look at just exercise or whatever it is. You know, it's the nutrition, it's the how you mentioned the values of the athlete. That's also important, which is going to lead me later on. I want to talk about quantitative versus qualitative research and how that kind of affects your research, but I don't want to jump the gun. Epistemology, which I hadn't heard that term prior to my first semester in grad school. So I'm in grad school pursuing a master's in kinesiology. I started this past fall in August, and you know, I took this sport sociology of sport class, and it was almost kind of like why not? You know, I almost didn't take it, but, you know, I was talking to the professor and, you know, she was like, oh no, you know, it's a really interesting class. You should take it. And that has really, you know, led me down this other path that I didn't even know was available. So I started learning about ontology and epistemology. And I think a lot of people are not familiar with that. But just to kick that off, epistemology essentially is the nature of knowledge, you know, the study of what is knowledge. And I think that a lot of times that fundamental concept can be responsible for disagreements, right? Because one person thinks this is what is known, and someone else is like, well, what about this stuff over here, right? So even the knowledge isn't necessarily accepted by both parties. You do want to touch on that, and we can go into ignorance navigation.
I like that, man. So I think a really interesting way to view, there's a way to start with epistemology.
I know, right? I didn't even know where to start.
I think a good way to start is with really dramatic examples, say, let's say from physics. So if I take an example, really dramatic example from physics. So in 1915, Einstein presented his field equations to the Prussian Academy of Sciences, and in essentially, which is basically laying the ground for what was going to be the general theory of relativity. And 4 years later, so up to that point, essentially the standard model for looking at the cosmological movement was Newtonian mechanics and Newtonian celestial mechanics. And then Einstein presented this work in 1915, which was essentially seven or eight years worth of work to reconcile gravity with his 1905 special relativity. And in 1919, then this guy Sir Arthur Eddington, who was one of the few people to publicly kind of have a grasp on what it was that Einstein's work was suggesting, he set up a kind of a two-pronged expedition to observe and to photograph an eclipse. One went to South America and one went to the west coast of Africa, to the same latitude. Is it? I think it's latitude is horizontal. I always mix them up. I always forget.
I think you're right. I'm not sure.
And so basically to photograph the eclipse, and essentially what the effect of that was that when one of the sets of photographs, there was it was very cloudy and they couldn't get a good picture. But in the other set of photographs, they could in the other location. And what that showed was it showed this bending of light, because essentially when they could get the photograph, they could see the other stars in the background that you normally can't see when you look at the sun. And they could see this bending of light that had occurred. And essentially what that meant was that there was a massive amount of weight lent to Einstein's theory. And that's when Einstein actually became very famous and very well known. So even though he presented the equations in 15, it wasn't until 1919 that there was this, oh my God, we're onto something here. And then what ended up, those field equations that he'd presented went on to be able to predict the existence of gravitational waves, which were detected for the first time from theory, went on to being able to predict gravitational waves, which were detected for the first time by LIGO in 2015. And they went on to be able to predict the existence of a black hole, which was photographed for the first time around this time last year. It was around April last year they got photographs they got actual pictures, which is fascinating because that basically meant that not a lot of people realize this, but I think it kind of went under the radar a bit because I think it was going to take it for granted that any photograph that we had ever seen or drawing or picture or illustration that we had ever seen of a black hole prior to April of last year was only an artist's representation of what it should theoretically look like based on equations presented in 1915, which I think is so cool. And then they got a photograph and it actually looked like it should have based on the prediction. So given, and I'm not a physicist, so this is just kind of my surface level understanding of the history of this scenario. And I couldn't tell you anything about the actual physics that's going on. I just love the history of it. So I suppose how that kind of fits in with illustrating epistemology is that how do we know what we know perspective, Einstein's field equations and what they were able to go on to predict could take into account what Newtonian celestial mechanics were able to do, plus a whole lot of extra stuff. So from a knowledge perspective, in terms of looking at the strength of the knowledge that's in that were of celestial mechanics versus Einstein's general relativity. General relativity is more useful to us. It's more likely. Doesn't mean that it's true. Doesn't mean that it's 100% true or infallible in light of any future evidence. Because there are kind of holes in general relativity, and there's iffy bits. And physicists have been trying for decades and decades to find out because there's a massive incentive to standing on Einstein's shoulders with new work. There's massive incentive to doing that, obviously, you know, for whole loads of reasons. And they haven't been able to just yet. So it doesn't mean that Einstein is true. his work is true. It's just more likely to be an accurate reflection of reality than Newton's celestial mechanics was, because it could do everything his work could do plus some extra cool shit. Or so that's maybe a way of giving a real world example of epistemology in action. So then essentially the best knowledge that we have on how cosmological movement works and how essentially why it is the planets move like they do, the best knowledge we have for that, that's most likely to be closer to truth, is general relativity. So that's maybe a way of looking at it. And then from a evidence-based practice perspective, as it relates to coaching, which this evidence-based practice model was taken from medicine. If you think of it, you can think of it in terms of like a hierarchy of evidence, which if you think about, say, from a drug trial perspective, actually, it's probably the easiest, is that from like a drug trial perspective, the peak of the pyramid would be like, actually, I'll start at the bottom. Like the bottom of the pyramid would be like expert opinion articles, and then we'd have like single case reports on single patients, and then maybe like case cohorts where there's multiple people that are just case reports. And then you work your way up the pyramid where you end up with things like let's say we go a bit further up the pyramid and there's a randomly controlled trial, and there's a whole bunch of randomly controlled trials that all show the same thing. And then there's at the very top of the pyramid would be a systematic meta-analysis of loads of other systematic meta-analysis, with each of those systematic meta-analysis analyzing loads of trials, individual trials. And then so a meta-analysis compiled of loads of other meta-analysis across multiple years that all showed kind of the same thing is the strongest, it's most likely to be closer to true than the evidence at the very bottom of the pyramid. So that's kind of another way, kind of like a real world example of epistemology in operation as it relates to how it is we know what we know about reality.
So essentially, is that to say that there are no absolute truths? It's just more of a relative truth. Something is more relatively more true than something else. Is that?
Yeah. Basically, so there's
I know that's a simplification, but
yeah, no, it is, man. That's such a strange thing to even talk about, because, like, for example, a really dramatic example would be that I can't even prove at 100% certainty that I'm actually having this conversation right now, and that I'm not just a brain in a vat, or I'm not like Neo in the Matrix or something, and I'm plugged into a machine, and this is all a simulation. Yeah. You know,
right.
Like, just look up if someone was to look up like Nick Bostrom and the simulation theory, Nick Bostrom of Oxford University and the simulation theory, and you're like, oh yeah, I can't even prove it 100% certainty that I'm even having this conversation, and that and that the kids playing out the back in the neighbor's garden aren't part of my simulation. And, you know, so like,
right.
The way there's a brilliant line by Voltaire that goes along the lines of, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd.
Mm.
And that's what it relates to. Like, so there isn't, and another example of this kind of uncertainty element would be, so basically the only certainty is uncertainty. So the only truth is that there is none. The only certainty is uncertainty. The only thing we can be sure of is that we can't be sure of anything.
Right.
And by sure, so there's absolutely the only thing that we can be certain of is that there's nothing that we can say that is infallible in light of any future evidence, essentially.
Right.
And in that respect, but that doesn't make the endeavor futile, because, for example, to bring it back to the Einstein example, even though we can't reach an absolute truth, or even if we do reach an absolute truth about the workings of, say, celestial mechanics and the way that gravity works or seems to work, we'll still never know if we've actually found it, because we won't know if it's infallible in light of any future evidence.
Mm.
And another example would be like, let's say another example of absolute truth in practice, and or the lack thereof, would be in the court system. So like if someone is getting charged with something, like let's say a really dramatic thing like murder or something, then there's no, the language that's even used is beyond reasonable doubt. So it's reasonable doubt. It's not beyond doubt. Mm-hmm. It's beyond reasonable doubt, because even if there's like, I don't know, a million witnesses that all see it at the same time, there is still the chance that there's a hallucination, or that there's something that went on that means that this person wasn't actually there, and they just happened to, because the human brain, we can never be certain that we're interpreting reality as it is, as it actually is. So, yeah. So
I like that. That highlights, one thing I like to say is, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that kind of highlights that really well. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, essentially gravity, you know, let's say gravity, for example, everyone kind of is in, there might be some higher ups in the scientific, institution that might be doubting it. But I think for the most part, everyone's like, yeah, you know, gravity's real, it's pulling us down. But we don't know, like you said, there might be future evidence that kind of contradicts that, right? And we don't. Right now, this is the best that we have. The evidence that we have is the best that we have. So we can't, we can't refute it now, but we don't know what information is out there that might refute it in the future.
100%. And here's a concept that I use to kind of frame this is I kind of called it. So if we start at a very kind of a fundamental level of when I'm formulating a view of reality, like it could be how I'm putting together a training program, or how I'm formulating an opinion about how to vote in an election, or how to anything. That's just essentially an opinion about what the most likely view of reality is. And an opinion is essentially just a form of creativity.
Mm.
And creativity is just a combination of known parts in an unknown way. You know, so because like if you think about any monster movies, these monsters are just made up of bits of other monsters or bits of other animals that are stuck together, you know. And there's nothing truly original. Everything is just standing on the shoulders of giants. It's all combinations. And then each time there's a novel, a step into the unknown, into the new, that's just created a new part that can then be used in combination with some other stuff to make another new thing, and so on and so on. That's how science works. That's how conjectures in science works. It's how artistic creativity works. So an opinion is just a form of creativity. Creativity is a combination of known parts in an unknown way. And you think about, well, if I'm formulating a view of reality about, let's say, political opinion as it relates to how to vote in an election, or how to design a particular aspect of a training program or a training session or anything like that, I can only formulate that opinion with information that I've had access to, from which I've been able to generate knowledge, or let's say with knowledge that I have. And then if you think about then, so as a single individual, I am a finite, limited, fallible, irrational primate. Like I share more genetic material with chimpanzees and bonobos than the African elephant does with the Indian elephant. In fact, I'm more closely related to chimpanzees and bonobos than I think they are to each other. So, and not only that, but I have an inherently limited primate brain. On top of that, just like you said, we can only know what we know. So, and I can only know what I've even been able to have, not just have had access to, but that I can even interpret and assimilate and make sense of. So let's say when it comes to generating an opinion, I can only generate that opinion with information that I've had access to be able to interpret and assimilate and generate knowledge from. And then unless I, that which essentially means that I can't be certain of anything unless I have access to all information that has ever existed anywhere in the universe, does exist now or will exist at any point in the future. And not only that, but not only do I have access to the information, but I have a, but my brain is actually capable of, because there may very well be information that exists that my, because there's nothing written into the laws of physics that we know about that states that everything that's in the universe is going to be understandable by a human. Like there's nothing we know of that stipulates that. It's not one of the laws of physics that we know of. So there's no, at a base level, there's information. There's the infamous Donald Rumsfeld had a line where he said, like, there's the known knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. So there's information that I know I don't know, and I don't even know that I don't even know. So because of that, I can't be certain of anything ever. The most absurd examples, like I don't know for sure, with 100%, absolutely infallible in light of all future evidence that I'm even having this conversation.
You're so, right.
And I call that, so there's this paradox. So, but in order to function in the world, a human needs to be able to generate opinions about what to do next, because we need to make actions. We need to take actions. And so there's this paradox. So we need to function in the world, but we can never be certain of anything. And that there's this paradoxical epistemic relationship. And I call that the axiom of the infinite unknown. Because an axiom is just a postulate that you accept and then you build upon it essentially in like an argument. Not an argument, it doesn't have to be an actual like aggression argument, but just in terms of you're building your arguments on top of it, this fundamental axiom. And the fundamental axiom as it relates to human opinion formulation is this fact that is undeniable, that we can't, that there's a gap, an enormous gap, between the knowledge that it's capable for me to have and the knowledge that is possible to have given what has existed in the universe and what will exist in the future in the universe. And that gap I call, the essentially I describe with this phrase, TAIU or T-A-I-U, the axiom of the infinite unknown. And that then sets the table for essentially ignorance navigation. So that's the phrase I kind of use on to describe all humans are ever doing is navigating ignorance. That we're and that's so important for people to realize, is that we're never able to be certain of anything because of the axiom of the infinite unknown. And after that, then it's I suppose it's another way of broaching or describing this, or I suppose it almost sets the ground floor actually for a concept that's put forward by I first heard described by Nassim Taleb, where he described epistemic humility and epistemic arrogance. Mm-hmm. Where epistemic humility is obviously it relates to epistemology, but epistemic humility is where someone puts the knowledge they don't have on a higher pedestal of importance than the knowledge they do have. And epistemic arrogance is the inverse then, which is I put the knowledge I do have on a higher pedestal of importance than the knowledge I don't have. So I'm essentially operating in the world in the kind of like a narrowed lens where I'm prioritizing what I know over what I don't know, versus in a kind of a more broad, open loop direction. I'm orientating in the world by prioritizing what I don't know. So, and that relates to I think if there was more epistemic humility in the world, there'd be a lot less conflict and violence and ideological grief and tribalism, especially, and right. Yeah, and distaste for the other, whatever the other is. You know, I think it's like one of the most important. That's why I love talking about this stuff, because it's the most important thing is for us to realize that we are these flawed, limited, finite entities, and that we have no right to that. And that's what W.B. Yeats was getting to in that line, the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passion and intensity. And I suppose that sounds strange to have the word passion or passionate, which is typically in our vernacular in 2020, associated with a negative. because passion is typically seen as something good, but it, words change in their usage over time. But you just think about trying to have a discussion with someone who's just screaming and shouting about their political belief, rather than entering the discussion in a way that they're willing to actually exchange information and orientate towards truth, rather than simply defend a viewpoint they already have as if they know what truth is. Mm-hmm. So
I think that's so interesting, because I think there's a paradox within that, right? Those who know that there's more information that they don't know and that they probably will never know, these type of people usually are more humble in their opinions. They're more willing to change their opinions. Whereas people who prioritize the knowledge they have, I think you referred to as epistemic arrogance.
Yeah.
They're so certain that what I know is all I need to know. This, you know, nothing else, it matters. These people usually don't know a lot, right? You know, the way I kind of, you know, I've been reading your articles, the way I kind of summed up the axiom of the infinite unknown is, you know, ignorance is essentially lacking knowledge. And, you know, we may become more knowledgeable in a particular area, we may gather more information, but we can't attain or fully comprehend everything that there will ever be to know in that area or in general.
Yeah. Right?
But I think it's important to know that even though, you know, we have, you know, 0.00001% of any information that's ever available to us, I don't think it's futile to seek to learn more, right?
Because
that is what's going to, you know, as we alluded to in the beginning, even though there's never an absolute certainty, we can create a relative truth, right? And that relative truth is proportional to what we know, right? It, again, in reference to your, that kind of pyramid of that we use in science, you know, randomized controlled trials are typically the gold standard, and then meta-analyses are even higher than that, or meta-analyses of the randomized controlled trials. Again, that's just giving us a little, you know, 1% more closer to the truth, but it's still, you know, there might be a randomized controlled trial that finds opposite, right? And that will take us back a little bit, but it's not futile to try to seek the truth. And now that kind of leads me into these kind of thinker types that you mentioned or you described. You mentioned scientific thinkers, believer thinkers, and victim thinkers. How would you, well, you know, I'll be honest, I've had an issue trying to reach some of these people where they are so, let's take the pandemic, for example. Some people watch a documentary, there was one going around called Plandemic, where, you know, certain doctors were, you know, advocating that, you know, this is a conspiracy, or there's tons of conspiracies out there. And for them, for these type of people, you know, they see themselves as like, hey, I'm just gathering information, right? So they kind of, in a way, they're going the right way, but at the same time, it's hard for them to distinguish what good information is from another's. So I guess, you know, I guess we can talk about one of your articles you mentioned, whether or not you are actually evidence-based or not. I don't want to skip over the types of thinkers. I guess we can talk about, can you describe these thinking types, and also knowing that these are not all encompassing, but usually we can kind of distinguish people into these kind of types, and then kind of talk about whether people are actually using proper evidence or if they're using it appropriately.
Yeah. So basically, the way I kind of thought about it, I spent a bit, I actually first kind of labeled these three types of scientific believer and victim back in, it was in, during 2016. So I've lived in America on four different occasions, and I actually lived there for I lived there for 7 months in 2016. So during the whole election campaign and everything, and during that period, I got to travel across so much of America. I traveled like across like 38. I've been in the 38 of the lower 48 states, which is like, I got to see a whole lot of really interesting aspects of America that aren't typically of the US, that aren't typically seen by tourists like myself, essentially. But I suppose the way to view it, the way I kind of framed it in the article was that, let's say I happen to be in a room or in a car with three people who it's discovered that through our discussion that not only did these three people hold different viewpoint to myself, but it, let's say it's the most different possible. Like, I don't even know. Let's say it's something really dramatic, like a flat earth or something, right? It's like, and just use conspiracy theory kind of this thing you mentioned earlier on. Rather than me just jump into a discussion and start exchanging information with these people, instead, I could kick off the discussion with just asking them, okay, I realize, so rather than just, I suppose, I think I use the phrase, like, rather than what likely race to a sweaty stalemate, where we're just kind of firing information at each other and trying to dissuade each other with information first. Instead, I could ask, well, what would it take for you to change your mind on this? And then the first person says something along the lines of, well, if you were to present me with sufficient information, I'd be willing to entertain the possibility that your view of reality is more accurate than my own. And then that's what I call a scientific thinker, because they're willing to change their mind in light of evidence. And then the second person says something along the lines of, you're wrong, I'm right, and I'm going to show you why. And that person isn't there to learn. That person is just there to defend a belief. So the first person, I kind of fit into a category of truth seeker, because they're genuinely just trying to orientate towards truth. The second and third person, I fit into a category of belief guardian, which is essentially that they're just latched onto this belief, or this belief has them, maybe is a better way of putting it. So that's the believer thinker was someone who's just there to defend their viewpoint. The third person doesn't even engage in discourse. And as an excuse, or sorry, they either figuratively leave the conversation by putting some label on you. Like, let's say in the conspiracy theory world, they like to use the word shill, or that you're brainwashed or whatever, you don't see the truth, and they'll use these sheep. The sheep. You're just one of these sheep, and they'll use that term or to discredit your opinion. So then they're figuratively leaving the conversation, or they could just literally leave the conversation. So they'll actually leave the space. So that's the victim thinker. So that's someone who they're not even going to defend their viewpoint. They're just going to leave the conversation because whatever, you're being offensive or whatever. And that person fits in with the believer thinker and being like a belief guardian. And that they're just going to I kind of think of it in terms of as versus has. So there's this old Carl Jung line, the depth psychologist Carl Jung had this line. He said, people don't have ideas, ideas have people. And I think that's true from one sense, because from a literal sense, I kind of consider myself a kind of a determinist, I suppose, in how I view reality, which is that I am the way I am as a result of the initial conditions at the Big Bang and the laws of physics, whatever those laws might be. And that I didn't choose my genetics. I didn't choose what I was exposed. I didn't choose where I was born. I didn't choose what my friends were exposed. I didn't choose the stress or lack of stress that my mom was exposed to while I was in the womb that shaped my whole loads of things. So like I am now, the way I am right now is it couldn't have been any other way given the initial conditions of the electron soup after the Big Bang. Like it just, that's just the way it is. Like, and, but at the same time, so in that sense, there's all these unconscious or even conscious ideas that I have that in that sense, they do have me because of all these things that I had no choice in, where I was born, who I was born to, and then all the other events that have ever happened in my life. But at the same time, I think I think it's a matter of, while that may be a closer to like a literal truth as it relates to science, like determinism of how the universe works and where my place is in it, there's also the side of things which I think you can consciously approach ideas that you may have. So I think, so in that sense, it's not that ideas, not that people don't have ideas, ideas have people. It's either people have ideas or ideas have people. So from this sense, if there are ideas that I'm not willing to let go of in light of evidence, then I don't have that idea has me. So the only, and again, the paradoxical situation is the only idea that I have that I'm not willing to let go of in future, in light of future evidence, is that uncertainty is the only certainty, which is a kind of, there's an element of paradox, or I don't know what you call it, irony in that.
Yeah.
But that's the only one. It's like the only one that I'm not willing to let go of is that I can't be certain about anything. It's like, which is so, there's a little paradoxical kind of loopy stuff going on there, but
right.
So that essentially, so after that, it's all fair game. You know, as I said, I just because I may be in the matrix. I don't even know. So anyway.
So, no, that's great. Something you said kind of lit a light bulb in my head, that I've been kind of playing around with these ideas of, you know, why do people disagree so much? Right. And again, it goes back to what you said before. We're all kind of navigating this ignorance. Some of us are more in tune with how ignorant they are, some are less ignorant or less in tune with that. And I kind of came up with this very simplistic explanation, and it's, I call it the paradigm tree. And if you've been reading more, you're more in tune with the philosophy than I am, so maybe this is already out there, but I call it the paradigm tree, where our experiences are at the very bottom. And then as we go up the tree, our experiences affect our attitudes and our behaviors, which in turn influence our beliefs and our perceptions. And so at the very bottom, you know, I think people try to change each other's beliefs, right? But we can't do that because our experiences subconsciously affect how we even interpret those beliefs. Yeah. And so, as you said, you know, there are an infinite amount of combination of factors that affect who we are today, right? You said, you know, the conditions that your mom was in, that you know, when she was given birth, you know, how she raised you, the pollution that was in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
Infinite amount of combinations. And so two people can have the same, be exposed to the same situation, and the experience will be different because that all that underlying stuff will predispose us to interpret it differently, right? And again, that leads to, oh, my attitude towards that experience is different than someone else. And in turn, my belief around that experience will be different than someone else. And then my perception will be different than someone else, right? So I think people don't realize that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're all human, but we try to change each other's, I mean, we get frustrated, and I get frustrated when someone doesn't think, you know, doesn't know what I know or what I think I know. But, you know, I try to look back and think, you know, why do they think that way in the first place? You know, and I think it's not, we can't change our experiences. They already happen. But if we can understand each other's experiences, then we can kind of go down the tree and say, like, you know, here, you know, we can kind of lead people, hopefully, out of that victim thinking or out of that belief thinking, and try to then turn them into that scientific thinker. But, you know, if we just attack people and say, hey, you know what, you're a sheep.
Yeah.
It's XYZ, you know, that we're not making any progress.
I couldn't agree with you more, man. Like, there's a prime example occurred the other night. So a very close friend of mine was shutting down his gym. And he's kind of switching business, and this he was thinking about it anyway, and then this kind of whole situation, and we're thinking about what he was going to do business wise anyway, but then this whole COVID situation kind of, I suppose, gave him an opportunity maybe to settle and to think, because he was no longer caught up in the day-to-day running of the business. And then he put these new plans in place anyway. So we were packing up his gym and putting loads of stuff in the storage, and afterwards after a long day of moving and physical work, it was nice. We were enjoying a few beers afterwards, right? And something that came up, like I mentioned Carl Jung earlier on, and we were discussing, so these two mates of mine the three of us that were left are all really interested in Carl Jung and philosophy in general. But so we ended up talking about these archetypes, and the trickster archetype came up, and an example of these different interpretations. So like, let's say me and my mate both read, if we both read a sentence or a paragraph that was referring to the trickster archetype, we would have interpreted that so differently based on our interpretation of the trickster and the way that we were discussing it. So like, I can use a kind of almost movie examples in that I was kind of viewing the trickster archetype from a perspective of the court jester, which is like the comedian, essentially, like the person who's able to speak truth to power in a way that's kind of pushing the boundaries a bit, you know, and almost like the flip side of the hero archetype, where the hero archetype essentially goes into the scariest part of the woods, and or essentially the hero archetype archetypally goes to the place that they least want to go to confront the thing that they least want to confront in order to bring back the gold to the community. Right. So they go to the scariest place to confront the scariest thing, and then they return with something of benefit to the community. The flip side of it, I was thinking about the trickster, because I'm not as familiar with the archetypes as the lads were. Mm-hmm. And I'm only just getting into the Jungian stuff of late. And the trickster, when my buddy's interpretation of it was more like Loki from Loki from the Avengers movie.
Yeah.
Which is more kind of, there's maybe a bit of goodness there, but a lot of the actions and a lot of the speaking truth to power is more kind of selfish or kind of right. Self-centered or narcissistic or something. You know, it's not
kind of like the Joker as well.
In the series.
So he speaks these kind of truths a little bit more cynical in the way he carries out action is not usually in the best interest of others, but doesn't necessarily mean he's wrong all the time.
And think about it though, even though there's differences there, and he actually, my buddy brought up the Joker actually as well. Mm. He's he loves the Joker, the Heath Ledger Joker in particular.
Yeah.
But I think in that sense, if you just think about that as an example, so even though me and him, we've both consumed so much similar content and in terms of different like books, and we have similar interests, we listen to similar podcasts and all that, and we're both roughly the same age and all this stuff and similar socioeconomic background and all that, but we could have read the same paragraph or the same sentence about this trickster and interpreted it so differently based on what assumptions we were coming to the table with. And that's a prime example, I think, just using linguistics as an example. And because if you think about any word, even if you take a really emotionally laden word like love or hate, that are really emotionally laden, like really in the English language, there's probably, I doubt there's any other words that are more emotionally laden than those. Obviously, it's going to be individual. There's going to be individual circumstances, but on average, let's say.
Right.
Okay. And even if I took a word like love, and then I said, and I took me and even my mate, and I said 20 words define love, and I had to go off defining love with 20 words, they're likely going to be drastically different definitions, even though they're words that are so emotionally laden, that are so visceral, you know, there's like a physical connection to the word. So in that sense, even, and then you expand out something as simple as that, which is like defining a particular word off the top of your head that's so emotionally laden and so embedded in our culture and our literature and our art. And then you take that out to big picture stuff, like the pandemic or social circumstances, like the stuff that's going on over in the US and your neck of the woods. Like then you think about, then you take about this kind of complexity where it's not no longer just defining a word, even a word that's so emotionally laden and viscerally attached to by a human.
Right.
And then you look at this complex web of all these different circumstances that could be around a particular event or a particular decision or something that a politician says or something that, you know, and then you're like, of course, we're all interpreting it. There's a brilliant line by this writer, Anish, I don't know how to pronounce her name. She said, we do not see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. And like, so to bring it back to the conspiracy theory thing that you mentioned earlier on, just for a second, in those circumstances, so given this reality that we don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are. And given that we have all, I think as humans, we have these innate tendencies that get in our way, these obstacles that get in our way to orientating towards truth. We have things like confirmation bias. Like it feels way nicer to pile up evidence to support an already existing viewpoint than it does to question our own viewpoint. And that doesn't feel comfortable, especially if you're not used to it. I still don't find it comfortable. And I think about this stuff all the time. You know? And we have things like tendencies towards, so we're these pro-social animals. We have these tendencies towards tribal behavior and tribal tendencies and blind tribal conformity, where we adopt certain opinions just because the people that we want to be socially accepted by also have these opinions. And there's just two examples. We have things like negativity bias, which serves a really powerful evolutionary function, where we were more likely to remember events or situations that cause a negative emotional reaction, like a fear or an anxiety or whatever, because that would have served a major evolutionary function in that, like, me and you were out, let's say 10,000 years ago, me and you were out hunting, right? And there was a third dude with us, and he took off after some animal earlier on in the hunt. And then later on in the hunt, me and you were strolling, and next thing there's a rumble in a bush. And I say, oh, that's Mongo over there in the bush. And you're like, I don't know, man. I don't think that doesn't sound like fucking Mongo. and then I'm thinking, oh, no, it's fine. It's like, so then I walk over to the bush, and then some tiger or some shit jumps out and bites my face off, right? And then you just run away, like, and then you tell everyone else. So like, you tell everyone else, he just got mangled by a fucking tiger because he thought it was Mongo. And then, so then our whole tribe then thinks, okay, rumble in the bush, be fucking careful. And now they have this story that they've been told that, so then anytime that, from a probabilistic sense, then that tribe then is more likely to avoid walking towards bushes that are rumbling funny. So then there's this, because there's this negative, and that's a really useful bias that we have, but it gets in the way of our ability to, and we have a poor ability to think in terms of probabilities. Like we have a really bad ability to think in terms of probabilities. So let's say I was discussing it with a close friend recently, this concept of male privilege as an example, right? And what the way I kind of described it was that like, let's say, so I'm like 215, 220 pounds, in that range. I'm like 6'2". I fought competitively for years. I think a lot less about the risks of parking in a dark car park than she does. Mm-hmm. If there's a load of banging at my door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and there's some really aggressive drunk dude outside the door, I'm far more likely to feel safe and feel like, okay, I can open this door, and I'm much more likely to be able to deal with what's on the other side of that door in a favorable manner, you know? Uh-huh. And that's, to me, that's a really dramatic example of, that's like a really obvious example of what a male, mm-hmm. what a male privilege is in terms of, from reality, because, right. And then if I think of it in terms of, let's say there's a nightclub, this is an example of negativity bias, that let's say there's a nightclub, and in the nightclub, there's 1,000 people, and 500 of them are dudes, let's say. And let's say out of that 500 dudes, 1% of them are creeps. So let's say 5 of them are creeps, right? Those 5 creeps could do so much harm to the reputation of men in that one night. If they walk around and they're feeling up chicks and they're grabbing women and they're being inappropriate. And all of a sudden, then you could have dozens of women, maybe more out of those 500 ladies that were there, that think that men are assholes, even though there was 495 men that weren't creeps. But that fits in with the Mongo example of we're more likely to remember things that cause a negative emotional stirring. So then, but we don't, our brains aren't wired to think in terms of statistics and proportions and probabilities. That's not what we're evolutionarily selected for, because that wouldn't have served an advantage on the savannah when we were developing evolutionarily. So I suppose the main thing from a critical thinking perspective is, like, given the fact that we have those kind of cognitive biases along with loads of other ones that I haven't mentioned, the most important thing then is, like, is to be aware that, okay, I'm likely wrong about loads of things. So my objective then should not be to just find out where I'm right continuously and keep reading the same media sources and keep talking to the same people and not question my own opinion. That the best thing I can do to orientate towards truth, if it can be this found at all, is to try and find out where I may be incorrect. How do I try and falsify my own viewpoint? So let's say from a perspective of science or political opinions or whatever, but I think Carl Sagan has a book called The Demon Haunted World. It's brilliant. It's called The Demon Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark. And he describes science essentially as this balance between wonder and skepticism. Mm. If there's too much wonder, then we can drift off into fairyland and all of a sudden we're like using tarot cards and healing crystals and shit, you know, and we're burning witches at the stake because we don't have science, and we're blaming witches for people getting sick instead of realizing that it's microbiology that we can't see with our eyes. And similarly, if there's too much skepticism, then we don't allow ourselves to be creative enough with our conjectures to generate new hypotheses that we can then test, some of which may very well be correct. Mm-hmm. So we have to balance wonder and skepticism. Those are the two things. And that's that same decision-making or opinion formulation heuristic is the same. That applies everywhere else, like especially if you use it, obvious, because things are so heated politically at the moment, that also relates to our political viewpoint and our how it is we view certain situations, how it is we view whether we're designing training programs for athletes or whatever. It's like wonder and skepticism. How do I let in enough information and entertain enough possibilities, no matter how absurd they may be, as if they may be incorrect? They may be correct, I don't know. But how do I do that while at the same time being willing to then take sledgehammers to my own viewpoints and by trying to find in where I may be wrong, not where I may be right? Mm. And it's that balancing act that needs to be struck. So like, let's say with these conspiracy theory people that you mentioned, Ron, I'm going on an epic rant here. Sorry, but I thought.
No, that's good. I'm running such down. So I'm going
to. Yeah. So like, the conspiracy theory stuff, it's like, to me, it just comes down to key questions like, okay, man, this is your viewpoint now, but where might you be incorrect? What might be your biases? What are your starting fundamental assumptions? Are you trying to be right or are you trying to reach truth? These are the kind of questions that I think lay the rules of engagement for the conversation. You know, because then it comes down to like, and like I mentioned, ironic, another key one might be like, for me, it's even, this is one I ask myself often, is like, am I trying to be right or am I trying to reach truth? And another way of looking at it is, am I coming from a place of knowledge or am I coming from a place of ignorance? Because if I'm coming from a place of ignorance, if I'm coming from a place of knowledge, then I'm trying to assert what I know. Whereas if I'm coming from a place of ignorance, I'm trying to learn. Mm. And that's that. They're like, because even though I think about this stuff all the time, I'm still human. Like I still get these almost physical reactions to having my own biases questioned, because I'm just like, I'm not fucking Data from Star Trek or Spock or something, you know, like I'm like, so So yeah, so that they're just kind of, that's a bit, that kind of, that bit of a riff there, or a rant, I suppose, was just covering, I think, just trying to knit together some ideas that were floating around.
All right, well, that was part one. I know, hopefully it didn't come to an abrupt stop, but I wanted to give you guys time to really reflect on some of these concepts. The first time I've heard about them, you know, the axiom of the infinite unknown and these thinker archetypes and epistemology, I was overwhelmed. Hopefully you guys won't be as much as I was, but definitely wanted to give you guys some time to just internalize these concepts and think about them before we move on to part two. And again, just trying to gain a foundation for philosophical ways of thinking and really trying to question our own beliefs, right? This is the best way, in my opinion, to think rationally and just think about what narratives and what rhetoric we're seeing out there. Because sometimes we think that it is well-intentioned, but upon further evaluation, you know, we might change our minds. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And again, stay tuned for the next episode, which I will hope to post this week as well. Thanks. I'll catch you next time. Athlete, Eclectic Athlete Radio.